Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. There are two stories out today about the depth of concerns that professional foreign policy officials in the Trump administration had about the shadow Ukraine policy that was shaping up this year. Axios has new details from the closed-door testimony in Congress last week of Trump's former envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker. He described to Congress concerns that he and others had about Rudy Giuliani seeming to be increasingly in charge of U.S. policy there. One central quote from Volker is this, quote, "Hanging over everyone's head in the expert community is there some grand bargain with Russia where we throw Ukraine under the bus," unquote. The other news story revealing the depths of professional concerns comes from the New York Times with new details of the testimony by Trump's former Russia and Ukraine expert, Fiona Hill. She worried about Trump's political appointee, Gordon Sondland, a hotel developer, of course, who had no previous government or foreign policy experience, but was given the lead on Ukraine policy, not just politicizing our diplomacy there, but actually being a national security risk. The Times article says Fiona Hill did not accuse Mr. Sondland of acting maliciously or intentionally putting the country at risk, but as metaphorically driving in an unfamiliar place with no guardrails and no GPS. Fiona Hill is quoted saying, "Sondland represented a counterintelligence risk because his actions made him vulnerable to foreign governments who could exploit his inexperience." That from the New York Times this morning. And guess what, folks? Gordon Sondland is testifying before Congress himself right now. It's surprising, considering his role in trying to get Ukraine to investigate the Bidens and the 2016 election for Trump, that he agreed to testify. Imagine the questioning he's getting right now. And there are early leaks from that closed-door testimony, like the Wall Street Journal is out with a dispatch just a few minutes ago. Headline, "Sondland criticizes Trump over efforts to pressure Ukraine." We'll learn what we can about that. Joining me now is New York Magazine national political reporter Gabe DiBenedetti. He has the cover story in New York Magazine this week, with the cover being a photo of a giant peach landing on President Trump. It's kind of a visual pun, I guess, impeachment. And the headline is one word, finally. Gabe's article focuses on the role of Nancy Pelosi and what a balancing act she has had to do. And yesterday, as you probably heard, she walked out of that meeting with Trump after he repeatedly insulted her with what I would call playground taunts, like calling her a third-rate politician and saying he hates ISIS more than she does. "I hate ISIS more than you do." Pelosi described Trump as having a meltdown. Hi, Gabe. Thanks for coming on today.
It is always good to be here.
First, the breaking news, as I know you've been following it, at least from here in New York, coming out of the House of Representatives about Gordon Sondland.
Yeah, it's pretty striking. Gordon Sondland, just to provide some context here, obviously has been a pretty close Trump ally for the last few years at least, but this is a longtime major GOP donor, a hotel developer in the Pacific Northwest who really has no diplomatic experience whatsoever before his current role. And a lot of folks were wondering why this was someone who, in his role as ambassador to the EU, was getting involved with Ukraine at all. Looks like what he's saying this morning is that he was concerned about the role that Rudy Giuliani was playing and that he was directed to go through Rudy Giuliani, and that Giuliani, again, this is according to reports that I've been reading out of Washington this morning, you know, made explicit the idea that a meeting between the Ukrainian president and Trump would be linked to the idea of an investigation into Hunter Biden, which, of course, is the whole question of a quid pro quo. Remember, Sondland is one of the people who was in that now very famous text exchange, explicitly saying there was no quid pro quo, which we now know was directed by Trump. He was directed by Trump to say that.
And the Wall Street Journal has some text from his prepared opening remarks, apparently, in which he says he, quote, regretted the departure of Marie Yovanovitch, the ambassador to Ukraine, who Trump ousted after Giuliani raised concerns about her. Apparently, she wasn't going along with the scheme. And Sondland also said, quote, inviting a foreign government to undertake investigations for the purpose of influencing an upcoming U.S. election, would be wrong. Withholding foreign aid in order to pressure a foreign government to take such steps would be wrong. I did not and would not ever participate in such undertakings. In my opinion, security aid to Ukraine was in our vital national interest and should not have been delayed for any reason.
Yeah.
Why is he breaking with Trump?
Well, it's not just him breaking with Trump. We're seeing now over and over a number of people, particularly from the State Department or foreign policy circles, essentially disregarding whatsoever the administration's more or less ban on their officials talking in this inquiry. It's very clear that Sondland feels that he doesn't have a choice but to talk at this point. He was supposed to talk to these investigators last week, but was turned around after the White House more or less forced him to turn around, go back to Brussels. This is not the kind of thing that you do unless you feel that you politically have to.
And his prepared remarks go on, according to the Wall Street Journal. Our view was that the men and women of the State Department, not the president's personal lawyer, should take responsibility for all aspects of U.S. foreign policy toward Ukraine. Please know that I would not have recommended that Mr. Giuliani or any private citizen be involved in these foreign policy matters. Now, it's so interesting, and I'm still trying to figure out where he's coming from, because he was one of the so-called three amigos who were named by Trump or Giuliani to get around the professional diplomats who were technically representing the United States there. It was Gordon Sondland, the Energy Secretary Rick Perry, who's also now announced his resignation, and Kurt Volker, former envoy to Ukraine, who is now also dished a little, apparently, behind closed doors.
That's right. And we have to remember what we were just talking about with the testimony from Fiona Hill, which was that Gordon Sondland was not regarded as a real diplomat or as a trusted diplomat by other members of the Foreign Service or other folks over in Europe. So obviously there are a lot of layers here, and the message that Sondland is sending today is rather different from what we've heard from him and from people close to him over the last few weeks. So I think that we're going to be watching pretty closely today to see what else comes out of this testimony, which I would wager is going to last for a very long time because there are a lot of questions to answer here. But what we're seeing—
Fiona Hill did 11 hours.
Nine hours the other day. Right. The idea being that there's essentially no time limit on these, and they just keep going as long as the House members doing the questioning or the staff doing the questioning are able to go, or for as long as they have questions. But a lot of the sort of takeaways here that we're hearing this morning sound very similar to what we heard yesterday coming out of the testimony from Michael McKinley, who was another longtime State Department State Department official, worked with Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, and he was essentially saying he stepped down after years and years and years of service, essentially saying that he was very concerned about the lack of support from the State Department towards officials who were getting caught up in this, but B, that he was also very troubled by the idea that foreigners were being approached for political dirt or for some sort of influence in our domestic elections. So we do have some broad strokes that are, you know, in the same direction here.
Nancy Pelosi.
Yes.
Your story is about Nancy Pelosi. That meltdown meeting yesterday was about Syria, not impeachment. But do they intersect?
That is actually the big question in Washington right now. The short answer is we don't think so. It's entirely possible because there are a lot of the similar players. There are a lot of Russian interests in particular in Syria right now. And whenever Turkey is part of the conversation, there is a lot of questions about the spheres of influence over there. However, what we do know is that Donald Trump can ill afford for Republicans to be upset with him right now. And yet, that's exactly where we are. Now, I'm not saying, and no one in Washington would suggest, that Republican anger with their president over his actions in Syria are likely to imperil him in the impeachment probe. But he really does need a lot of Republicans on his side in terms of defending him in the national arena, in the media. And when it does come time to actually have a vote, for example, in the Senate over impeachment, again, we're not hearing that these folks are going to break from him, but they are very upset with him over what's happening in Syria.
I presume these leaks are coming from House Democrats about the depth of concerns they're hearing about, you know, from inside the Trump administration over Rudy Giuliani and the so-called Three Amigos hijacking Ukraine policy, according to testimony at these closed-door hearings. Do you think the leaks are part of a strategy organized from the top by Pelosi to control the narrative while these hearings remain closed door?
Well, it's important to remember that there are a lot of House Republicans and indeed Senate Republicans and Republican staffers who are not happy with Rudy Giuliani's sort of unilateral activity or activity directed by the president. Anyway, so let's just stipulate that. But it is a good question. The strategy, as Pelosi has outlined it, at least to her caucus and to her allies, is essentially to try and get this done as quickly as possible. They're trying to do this all behind closed doors right now so that the testimony cannot be coordinated by, you know, by the president and the president's allies. We don't know if these leaks are part of some sort of orchestrated strategy. I would suggest that that's certainly peripheral to the central idea here, which is to try and get to as much of the truth as possible in as short amount of time as possible, which is, of course, complicated because there's now sort of a flood of information coming in from all of these officials who all of a sudden appear willing to testify or to be deposed after the House started issuing subpoenas. And we now have a real question about the scope of an eventual set of impeachment articles, but also about what the timeline is here.
But let me follow up on the closed door part, because Republicans are complaining about the closed door hearings and want them to be public, assuming that that would help vindicate the president if people heard the entire context
of
you know, these witnesses and what they're saying. But I would also think it might be in the Democrats' interest to have these pieces of theater, if you will, out in the open for the American people to see. Remember, they wanted to sort of stage the Mueller report by having, you know, the president's former White House counsel and all these people who said incriminating things about him in private to Mueller come before the cameras. And if it's as bad as what we're hearing from so many of Trump's appointees, why wouldn't Nancy Pelosi want this all to be done before television cameras, or what would be the next steps to take some of this public?
Yeah, well, we do know there are a few parts to this answer. One is we do know Adam Schiff, who is leading the Intelligence Committee and sort of spearheading a lot of what's going on right now in the impeachment inquiry, has said, we will be releasing the transcripts, we will be putting out the information that's coming out here, but not yet. And the strategic imperative here for House Democrats is basically they want to make sure that this is all behind closed doors. One, so that it is sort of responsible. We know what happens when these things go before television cameras. All you have to do is look at some of the prominent hearings from the last few years to see how they've gone off the rails as you have House members performing, more or less. But two, more importantly here, they really don't want people who are testifying, whether they are administration officials, former administration officials, or even people who are somehow allied with the president or have been in the past, coordinating their testimony. Now, we are getting little pieces of leaks, as we've discussed here, but if you did have some sort of coordinate, it's much harder for the White House to mount a coordinated defense here if they don't know what every single person is saying. And the idea now, if you are Adam Schiff or you're Nancy Pelosi or you're one of the investigators, is if you can promise Gordon Sondland, for example, that he is going to testify behind closed doors, he's not going to be worrying in the same way about, you know, Donald Trump live tweeting his testimony or White House lawyers saying you have to say this, this, and this.
You describe Pelosi as elevating Adam Schiff, chair of the Intelligence Committee, to the lead public face of the process over Gerald Nadler, chair of the Judiciary Committee, who had had that role. How and why did Pelosi do that?
Yeah, this was a long conversation that's been happening in the House. One piece of it is that this is about the Ukraine issue in particular, and that appears to be a narrow intelligence issue. So that made sense that Schiff's committee would take charge here. The other thing to remember before I sort of dive into the personal dynamics is that Nadler's committee, the Judiciary Committee, will still be the committee to bring eventual impeachment articles because that's the way that this process works. So it's not as if he's been entirely sidelined. However, the context here is that the Judiciary Committee is made up of a lot of very progressive members who've been very aggressive about trying to push these investigations into the president ever since Democrats took back the House and took back over in January. And many of them have indeed begun calling what their work was, began calling it an impeachment inquiry early on, earlier before Pelosi suggested that she was behind it, behind such an inquiry as well. And that really made a lot of moderates in the House caucus a little bit nervous. So what they essentially were saying is there were a lot of people in the caucus who were not happy with the way that the Judiciary Committee was stepping forward and making such an aggressive show of trying to impeach the president. They didn't think that that was politically or legally prudent. And then the last thing that sort of tipped them over the edge was the hearing last month with Corey Lewandowski, President Trump's former campaign manager, which turned into a sort of, as I wrote, a filibuster session, a hyper-partisan filibuster session. And after that, there were a lot of House Democrats who sort of said, we can't have these guys who have sort of said that they want to impeach the president running the show if this is what it's going to look like.
My guest is Gabe DeBenedetti, national correspondent for New York Magazine. His cover story in the magazine this week is about Nancy Pelosi and the impeachment process. There was a moment this week, Gabe, that I think only people paying close attention to this story probably noticed. But on Tuesday, Pelosi held a closed-door meeting of the Democratic caucus, and for a few hours, the cable channels were full of speculation that she was going to accede to Trump's demand that in order to hand over documents and allow witnesses like Rudy Giuliani to testify, she should hold a formal full House vote to authorize the inquiry. Now, she's not required to do that under the law. We should be very clear about that. There's no requirement under the law or the Constitution or House rules. But Congress did hold such a vote to authorize even the start of the inquiry in the Nixon and Clinton processes. But then Pelosi came out to the cameras Tuesday night and said no. So why didn't she just call his bluff and then have that card to play and demand these witnesses, Rudy Giuliani, come before us, we've subpoenaed you, documents, Mike Pence, we've subpoenaed your documents, he's saying no, and then they'd get produced?
Sure. Well, the short answer is like what you already said. They're not required to do this. They were already in an impeachment inquiry according to the rules of an impeachment inquiry, and they are subpoenaing all these people. They are asking for all of this information. The concern was that if they did call for this vote, then A, they would be endangering moderate Democrats who don't want to be on the record right now. But much more importantly, that they would then be acceding to Trump's game. They would be playing Trump's game and playing this all on Trump's terms. It's very important for Pelosi, as we've seen in her public communications about this so far, and indeed in her private communications with the caucus, to make clear that they feel that they have control of this whole process and that they're not in an ongoing back and forth with the White House. This is why when the White House sent them a letter saying essentially, we're not going to cooperate, Pelosi didn't say, okay, let me go talk to the White House about this. She said, that's not how this works. We're in charge of an inquiry, and this is happening one way or another. So it is true that there is precedent to have this kind of vote to open the inquiry. That does not mean that it is necessary. And essentially, the idea of calling his bluff, Pelosi believes we're well beyond that if we're talking from the perspective of the House Democrats. It's not worth it to have that sort of political maneuver when at the end of the day, what they are doing is a constitutional inquiry.
A piece of important context here, I think, is that Democrats took back the House last year, mostly by winning in swing suburban districts. The last thing those voters were thinking about was Ukraine, and new members tended to downplay the Mueller investigation, which maybe the voters were thinking about to some degree. But, you know, compared to pocketbook issues like health care, a lot of these swing voters and swing districts wanted healthcare front and center, Mueller investigation downplayed. Is the calculus changing for those districts with all these revelations about, you know, Trump allegedly selling U.S. foreign policy in exchange for investigations into Joe Biden and even now Hillary Clinton?
Yeah. Part of the calculus is changing, which is that this, what we've seen, especially with the Ukraine call, that information is so overwhelmingly easy to understand and easy to explain that these members of Congress feel they have no choice in many cases, but to call for an impeachment inquiry. But it's very important that we step back and remember that what the House is actually doing, or at least what Nancy Pelosi says she's doing, is focusing still on policy, not on impeachment. And if you look at what's coming out of her office, for example, it has a lot to do with their drug pricing initiative, which they're very proud of, their conversations with the administration and with Republicans over trade. They're basically trying to put out a message saying, yes, we can do both things at once. We are impeaching the president, but we are also running a functioning House. And this is largely because of the concern that a lot of these members in the middle have, and frankly, a lot of the members who are not in these brand new, newly Democratic districts have, that they're going to be painted as carrying out some sort of hyper-partisan process here. There is still a lot of scared memories of 1998. A lot of people in the House, including those who weren't there at the time, believe that Republicans at the time overstepped and that that's why they didn't make the political gains that they thought that they would while impeaching President Clinton. Now, we can talk about the reality of what happened there, politically speaking, but there is still a big concern that they are going to be seen now to be overreaching, and that's why they're not talking about this as their primary, talking point.
So last thing, what do you see as the timeline going forward toward an impeachment vote? I get calls every day from people saying, They have enough right now. Just go.
Yeah. Well, and there are certainly some people in the caucus who actually believe that, but there is still an ongoing conversation about what the scope of this eventual articles of impeachment are going to be. Some people say just focus on the Ukraine column, what we already know. Some people say we need to bring in all the stuff about that Mueller talked about. Let's remember there were 138 members of the caucus who were calling for President Trump's impeachment or an impeachment inquiry even before the Ukraine information came out. And then there's more and more coming out about obstruction, about what we're hearing every single day from every one of these pieces of testimony on Capitol Hill. The short answer, I know this hasn't been a short answer, but the short answer is we have no idea. We're thinking that House Democrats believe they'll be able to wrap up some version of this in the next month or two, and then it will move to this. They'll move to a vote and then to the Senate at some point before the new year. A lot of Democrats are very concerned that this could overlap with the beginning of votes in the Democratic presidential primary early next year. Mitch McConnell told his caucus yesterday, the Republican senators, that he believes that they'll be in a place to have some sort of trial around the end of the year.
Well, thanks a lot. And peaches are going out of season now, so go enjoy that New York Magazine cover before next week.
Thank you, Brian.